It's time now for Alaska Tracks, an oral history of Alaska people and their way of life, celebrating the rich heritage, wild landscapes, and deeply rooted stories of Alaska past. Alaska Tracks, brought to you by Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware, Ginger Oram with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding Extreme North Trailers, and Mont Saw Shop. And now your host, respected wildlife biologist and outdoorsman, Randy Zarnke.
Good afternoon, Fairbanks. This is Randy Zarnke with you for another episode of Alaska Tracks. This program draws on a series of oral history interviews I recorded with outdoors men and women from around Alaska. We tried to capture the lifestyle of dedicated biologists, fishermen, pilots, trappers, guides. They shared their favorite memories of their lives in the outdoors. You'll hear both detailed experiences and broad interpretations. Last week, we started a series of three programs with Sam Harbo, who was a wildlife professor at UAF and also served on the Board of Game, where his wealth of knowledge and solid reasoning benefited the hunters and trappers here in Alaska. Today, we'll launch into a second episode with Sam. Let's get started. In this first section, Sam recounts the history of predator control in Alaska. I lived through some of the events he relates, but I've never heard a more direct and analytical description of the rationale behind the many changes this program has taken over the years.
It is interesting to reflect for a moment on the perceived problems that we had with fish and wildlife management. Going back to the pre-statehood days, when the Fish and Wildlife Service was in power, probably the most active branch of the Fish and Wildlife Service was predator control. Their predator control was widespread and intensive. They had miles and miles of gitter, which are contrivances that have a bait, and when a predator would go ahead and bite the bait, it would shoot a lethal dose of cyanide into the animal, killing it. Well, they would put miles and miles of trails of these gitters along most of the navigable streams in the interior, as well as along many of the road systems. I can remember driving up to 12 Mile Summit on some caribou monitoring. We would go up there when the cows were returning from Preacher and Campion Creek with newborn calves and count the ratio of calves to cows. I can remember walking up back of 12 Mile and finding two dead grizzly bears that had been the unfortunate victims to gitters that were set out primarily for wolves. Apparently, the predator control operations of the Fish and Wildlife Service were very effective because not only were the wolf populations fairly reduced, but also the bear populations, I think, in many places were fairly reduced. And as a result, the moose and caribou populations in the interior almost universally were increasing. At least that was the assessment of the biologists in the Fish and Wildlife Service and the biologists in the newly formed Department of Fish and Game. In a little side note, the biologists in the Fish and Wildlife Service tended to really look cross-eyed at the predator control because they felt that you didn't need predator control to maintain good ungulate population, which was, of course, the direct result of some of Arrington's work, primarily on muskrat, but unfortunately were then related without any caution to large ungulate population, even though Arrington had cautioned, let's not do this, because the relationship of ungulates and predators is different than the relationship of Bob White to their predators or muskrats to their predators.
Well, let's clarify that one point. The staff members at the Fish and Wildlife Service weren't real...
The biologists tended to be fairly critical.
But there was another arm, the control arm, that
right.
was out stringing the gitters along.
Yes, yes. And the head of the Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska was firmly behind the predator control program. Anyway, by the time the state took over, the early biologists, such as Bob Rausch and others, realized that ungulate populations were very high. The wolf and bear populations were fairly low. And they decided that the first thing we needed to do was to start protecting a little more the bears and wolf populations, particularly from predator control and certainly from the indiscriminate control that the getters and poison baits used to have on predators. So they raised the wolf to a game species and started putting regulations on it. Also, they perceived that one of their primary problems in wildlife management, as far as ungulates was concerned, in Alaska, particularly in the Nalchina Basin and a couple of other areas, was getting enough hunter pressure to control the ungulate population. So they tried to liberalize as much as they possibly could the caribou seasons and bag limits on the Nalchina caribou herd, because they were concerned about the size of that particular caribou population. So for a period of about 4 or 5 years, their primary emphasis was to try and encourage hunters to hunt the Nalchina caribou herd. In retrospect, that certainly is very different than what we experience today. The new Department of Fish and Game was very effective in shutting down most predator control in the state. The only predator control that they couldn't immediately shut down was still the Fish and Wildlife Service predator control around some of the reindeer herds in western Alaska. But eventually that was also shut down. Whether or not it was a direct response to the decrease in pressure on predators or not, which some biologists say that's still an open question, the predator population started increasing. And all of a sudden, the biologists realized that the ungulate populations were starting to feel some pressure, which then initiated a lot of new research on ungulates. To make a long story short, the studies indicated that in certain localities, it was obvious that particularly the moose populations were being impacted by wolves, but also, subsequently they determined, by bears, as well as probably some of the caribou population. So, not many years after the Department of Fish and Game had decided they needed complete protection, practically, on predators, they decided they needed some well-directed and rigidly controlled predator management on wolves in particular. Well, by this time, of course, much of the population in the lower 48 had decided, no way do we want predator control, because wolves had been raised to an elevated status as far as a wildlife critter was concerned. So although the department went ahead and recommended some predator control programs, and the Board of Game went ahead and adopted some small predator projects, there was a tremendous outcry from much of the lower 48. And the issue quickly became a political issue. It is only recently that the department has been able to actually pursue some limited predator control programs. There's still debate as to whether or not predators can control prey populations, but I think almost all knowledgeable wildlife biologists conclude that wolves and bears can definitely hold moose populations in particular at relatively low levels for protracted periods of time. But it is really interesting to look back and see how the perceived problems by the managers changed over the years. From trying to increase the numbers of ungulates to then trying to decrease the number of ungulates by increasing hunting pressure, to then back to the problem of trying to increase the number of ungulates. It was nice in the days when the human population of Alaska was so small that many of these relatively remote game populations were not touched except by very limited, truly subsistence hunting by local residents. With the advent of snow machines, off-road vehicles, and airplanes, the hunting pressure has become widespread. And there are very few game populations that aren't utilized to a large extent, with very little surplus remaining. One of the things that became obvious in serving on the Board of Game, but also it became obvious at the university, was the fact that whenever a conflict arose between consumptive use, in other words, hunting or fishing, and non-consumptive use, that the non-consumptive use should hold sway, that the consumptive use must give way. It was really obvious once at a game board meeting in Anchorage. By Potter Marsh in Anchorage, there is a walking, hiking, and bike trail that goes around the edge of Potter Marsh. And I can remember one board meeting where a couple of residents who lived right above Potter Marsh wanted us to close the waterfowl season on Potter Marsh because, they said, in biking by there during the waterfowl season, sometimes they felt that shotgun pellets could land on the bike trail. So they wanted to close the waterfowl season. We asked them how long that the waterfowl season impacted the hiking trail. And they said, well, it's about a month, because there's about a month of intensive hunting there, and then it tapers off to the extent that it isn't really bad. We said, well, what about the other 11 months? No, that was fine. It's just that 1 month. I said, you've got 11 months. The hunters have 1 month. You want to shut their 1 month off so you can have 12 months. I said, wouldn't it be fair, since you've got 11 already, to close the trail for 1 month and allow the hunting? That was received very coolly. But it just brought to focus, I thought, the fact that there has to be a compromise here, that it can't strictly be one way. And in looking at a number of other issues where there has been a conflict between consumptive and non-consumptive uses, almost invariably the pressure has been to cut out the consumptive use.
As I said, that is the best retelling of the justification and policies related to predator control, and also how people and agencies change their positions over the years. Now let's take a break for a word from our sponsors. As always, we appreciate our sponsors. Without their support, we wouldn't be able to gather here once per week and listen to these great interviews with our special guests. Now let's get back to our interview with Sam Harbo. In this next segment, Sam talks about the ongoing debate between consumptive users of wildlife versus people who are opposed to consumptive use. He sees some lack of credibility in the arguments posed by the anti-consumers.
It was highlighted at a meeting we had with the Fish and Wildlife Service and a number of other interested parties regarding hunting of the caribou population on the flats on the Kenai Peninsula. And again, there was the contention that the consumptive use was impacting the non-consumptive use for a short period of time. So I again raised that question with the Fish and Wildlife Service, and I was dismayed at the response of professional biologists. to think that, my gracious, if there is a conflict, a compromise has to be strictly on the consumptive side. It's almost as though even professional fish and wildlife biologists, who are essentially resource managers, are apologetic as far as consumptive use is concerned, that there's something that isn't quite ethical about it. So if there is a question, we need to back off. And I see that as just a burgeoning problem in the increasingly urbanized America, that I think the bastion of consumptive use is going to be in those strict agricultural states, and particularly in those ranching states, where the populace tends to recognize the fact that you've got to harvest some of these livestock populations, otherwise they will just be out of control. They've got that ingrained understanding that some of these populations have to be harvested and that it isn't bad. And looking at it from a conservation and a ecological and environmental point of view, it makes sense utilizing these wild ungulate populations where we don't have to change and impact the underlying systems, that processes that run that system, that we should be utilizing those populations. And it's very true in Alaska that many of our moose and caribou populations should be utilized by consumptive users rather than putting additional pressures in the lower 48 to bring up meat that is produced with high energy consumption, but trying to convince environmentalists of that argument is very difficult, if not impossible, project. The thing that we're lacking, I think, is a degree of sophistication in the environmental movement that allows them to recognize when it is value systems they're talking about rather than environmental issues they're talking about. And I think if wildlife biologists need to correct anything as far as their future well-being is concerned, it is that basic understanding. They've got to get across to the environmental groups that there has to be, for everyone's benefit, a separation of what is truly a value system judgment and what is truly an environmental issue.
And yet it seems that the next generation of wildlife biologists coming out of the university these days, many of them start their career with those non-consumptive values, and they don't have experience as consumers. So do you share my interpretation, and what do you see in terms of those people taking positions with wildlife management agencies and what it means in the future?
No, I really do share those concerns for two reasons. As you say, first, the individuals coming into the programs are preconditioned already, because almost all of them now come from urban environments. In fact, almost the entire U.S. has been urbanized. The other difficulty that I see in the universities is that very few of the faculty have any work experience outside of an academic experience, which means that they've been fed the same pablum all along. So they reinforce what they're so convinced is right, because they have not been experiencing anything else. I can remember quite a few years ago, a couple of Norwegians came over who were taping a radio program about wildlife in Alaska. And they interviewed two of us on the faculty. One of the questions they asked is, why are so many people opposed to consumptive use of fish and game, but particularly of wildlife. And why has it changed so? Why don't we have stronger voices for conservation, as Aldo Leopold indicated it? That meaning wise use, but utilization, because he recognized the need to utilize. That was one of the questions they posed. And then the other one was, why don't we have more environmental concern these days about some of these wildlife issues? Why are we so concerned instead for individual welfare of animals rather than population welfare of animals? If a whale is stranded someplace, why is there such immediate concern about freeing that whale? And it was really a couple of interesting questions because it brought together a number of different things. First off, it revealed to me that we have people looking at wildlife populations very differently than they used to. They look at them in terms of individuals. And suddenly it struck me that the reason is because no longer do we have a rural population in the United States. We've got an urban population. They don't understand population dynamics. They can understand individual animal welfare, but they can't understand that some individual animals might have very poor fortunes, but the population itself might have better fortunes in place of it. So we tended to concentrate on individual animal welfare. And I think that's one of the reasons why the wolf conflict is such a bad one. And it's certainly one of the reasons why the Guns of Autumn had such a tremendous impact. We've just become urbanized. It's a real problem for fish and game managers because all of that urbanization is doubly enforced, I think, both at the student level and at the faculty level at our institutions of higher education. So I think what we're training are excellent Park Service biologists, but very poor wildlife managers.
So do you see a solution? Is there a way to turn it around for those of us that still support the consumptive use?
The short answer is I don't see any easy solution. And looking long-term, I don't see any long-term solution either. It's a very difficult problem. I just don't see how we're going to be changing because it's obvious we just become more and more urbanized. Fewer and fewer people are exposed to raising and providing renewable natural resources. We tend to be consumptive users in an urban setting who have the voting power. I think it is going to get worse. When you look at the northern environments, like we have here, and it's going to be environmentally degrading if we go ahead and don't utilize these resources locally. What are we going to replace them with? The Peter people say, well, we've got to quit eating meat. Well, what do you want to do then? Turn all of this into raising soybeans and so forth? What do you have to do to raise soybeans? In the northern cold soils, you have to fertilize heavier than you do in the warmer soils. Where do we get the fertilizer? Petroleum. So we're going to trade utilizing caribou, where we essentially spend no petroleum to harvest them, and replace them with soybeans, where we have to use petroleum. This is where we need to get some sophistication in our environmental groups so they can begin to see the fallacy of some of their arguments and the fact that they're defending their value system, not sound conservation or environmental issues.
And yet people like you have been espousing that argument for decades now. It seems to fall on deaf ears.
It doesn't resonate with anyone.
It comes down to a personal value.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It's like setting aside wilderness areas. The environmentalists have the creed, think globally, act locally. Well, every time you set aside a wilderness area, which means you're not really going to utilize it, Unless you change your consumptive patterns, you're going to be switching the utilization that you had in that wilderness area to some other area that's probably already impacted more than it should be. So you're going to be doing something that is environmentally negative rather than positive. And we just can't get that message across. That's why I say we need a degree of sophistication in the environmental movement that we just don't have. We talk about fish and wildlife management and trapping and so forth, but it all comes back to this basic attitude that the majority of the people in the U.S. have toward resource. That's going to determine what happens to trapping in Alaska, fishing in Alaska. It's not encouraging.
Well, Sam gave us a lot to think about there, didn't he? I hope that made you think and will stick with you for a while. That's all for today's episode of Alaska Tracks. Join us again next week when we finish off our series with the wise man of wildlife, Sam Harbaugh.
You have been listening to Alaska Tracks, a blend of interviews, storytelling, and firsthand accounts from Alaskans who know the land and carry forward the traditions of this remarkable state. Alaska Tracks has been brought to you by Ginger Orem with Crown Real Estate, Interior Welding and Extreme North Trailers, Rod Saw Shop, and Frontier Outfitters and Century Hardware. Join us next Saturday for another episode of Alaska Tracks, about Alaskans, for Alaskans, by Alaskans.